This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the metaversal learning space where you and I get 28 minutes with the top experts to understand a big issue. This week, is a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine feasible? And if so, what might it look like? As the bombing and shelling continues in Ukraine, so too do negotiations between invader and invaded on what might bring it all to an end. It's the obvious big question. If some sort of peace is to be concluded, what compromises might be required, and are those compromises at all likely? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, let's consider the Ukrainian position. Oleksiy Semeny is director at the Institute for Global Transformations and is a former advisor to the National Security and Defence Council of Ukraine. He's in Kyiv. The Briefing Room's Rosamund Jones asked him about his country's negotiating position.
Much more better than it was the case of the previous rounds held in Belarus. Firstly, humanitarian corridors and maybe, and I hope it could be exactly in the next days, maybe some agreements on ceasefire in concrete locations to provide these humanitarian corridors. Then some agreement, for example, about exchange of detained or imprisoned, I mean, military persons or dead persons. That could be definitely, but they have not reached agreement maybe on the major issues discussed. Both sides understand that, for example, how either ceasefire or settlement should look like depends exactly on the situation on the battlefield. And this makes it extremely difficult for negotiations because on the negotiation, you need some kind of line from which you start, some kind of basic assumption. And when the assumptions are different, this makes the whole deal quite difficult.
So you say there has been some areas now where there is agreement. Is one of those, yeah. I mean, Zelensky has said that joining NATO is no longer an aim. So is that one of them on which both sides are agreed?
I suppose yes. On the one hand, this is one of the issues which were mentioned beforehand by the Russian counterparts as a very sensitive for them. And on the other side, Ukrainian before the war actually stated the aim is to join NATO. Now, actually, Ukraine by itself declared that due to the reaction from NATO, Ukraine maybe no more refers to NATO as its aim to be a member of. So actually the issue by itself somehow evaporates.
Because NATO has made it quite clear that it won't intervene, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Then, of course, it comes the question to Ukraine, why do we need this membership? If in the case of war, which is really going, we don't have and we will not have what we actually would like to have.
Zelensky's position on NATO. Was that partly also made easier because actually the Ukrainian people had realised that that was no longer going to happen? To what extent, overall, is public opinion in Ukraine a significant factor in any negotiating position that Ukraine takes?
This is a very huge factor because now both President Zelensky and, for example, negotiation team in their communication negotiations very much refer to the public opinion or public mood as they understand it. And on the issue of NATO, it's very interesting because after the war started, in the first days, there were made some polls where actually the support of this membership was approximately going up to 60-70%. But it was an effect mainly that, okay, we should apply because now we have an aggression and we need some kind of security, and NATO could be. But after 3 weeks of war, when the most substantial issue now is about for example, air protection or just direct military support, which is not the case going to be. And then by the people, it's a hard reality check that actually NATO membership is not equal to our security.
What about demilitarization? That's something that Russia has talked about?
Yes, I suppose, but it's a very sensitive area because it is connected to this idea of getting some kind of security guarantees or being neutral state. It is connected because then, okay, you can discuss parameters of your military power. But this is exactly the devil is in the details. The discussion on the issue is already on the table. To what extent it can be successful, it's a very huge question mark because it depends on the situation on the battlefield. Russians suppose they can get further in some directions on some symbolical wins. The Ukrainian sides think it's not the case. We are quite successful in deterring them, and maybe defeating us is not on horizon. And then this influences exactly to 100% the discussion on this issue.
So it will depend on your analysis of how well you are doing against the Russians.
Yeah. Plus, any kind of such agreement, even about ceasefire, need to be supported by the Ukrainian society. And neither the president nor negotiation team are going to agree on something which the society will not accept. For example, if we take the main four requirements from the Russian side, namely the first one, okay, demilitarization, then about security status and acknowledgement of Crimea and Donetsk, Lugansk as not a part of Ukraine. So from 4 points, three are fully unacceptable, both for president and for Ukrainian society. There is even no space, not even for compromise, even for discussion. Only 1 point about security status is open for discussion.
So the red lines still are obviously those issues.
Yeah, there will be no agreement on acknowledging Crimea or Donetsk, Lugansk as not a part of Ukraine. Now, approximately, I suppose, if I'm not mistaken, 70-75% are not ready just to accept that Crimea or Donetsk, Lugansk is not a part of Ukraine.
I guess that could change if Ukraine continues to endure the losses that it has so far.
No. Even in the worst case, if, for example, we are going to be militarily defeated, we are sure we will win. Okay, it will take longer period, more losses from our side, but more, let's call it, disastrous losses for the Russians. There will be, let's call it, guerrilla war, total elimination of any Russians on our territory, regardless who they are, until the current regime of Putin is over and maybe the Russian state in its current form is over as well. Moreover, with all these humanitarian losses, bombing and shellings on the civilian infrastructure, they even increase the toughness of this position. So this is a little bit paradoxical maybe for the Westerns to hear, but actually there are really some red lines which we are not going to cross in any case.
Oleksiy Semeny, now let's hear about Russia's position. Dr. Aglaya Snetkov is the author of Russia's Security Policy Under Putin and a lecturer at the School of Slavonic and East European Studies in London. Do you detect any strong sense from the Russians that because of Ukrainian resistance, the objectives that they originally went in with, some of them may now be unachievable or have to be subject to negotiation?
everyone assumes that, at least at the start, they thought it would be sort of a simple blitzkrieg, maybe something akin to, let's say, Georgia 2008, when Russia moved troops into Georgia, and that is called sort of the five-day war. And so that level of victory is obviously unachievable. Now, the question is what they will be asking for in terms of negotiations. And many commentators and Western leaders have actually suggested that the Russians have not moved very far from their original goals, which primarily are about Ukraine, NATO membership, and the status of Crimea and Donbass. And on that, they don't seem to have moved at all. There is debate as to whether or not President Zelensky is agreed or threw out the idea of, let's say, Ukrainian neutrality.
This question of neutrality, as you're talking about it, of course, seems quite opaque, doesn't it? If Ukraine were to say, yes, we are prepared to go into a security arrangement in which we are neutral, what would Russia understand that to mean concretely? What would have to be offered for that to have meaning?
Two things to keep in mind. The desire to become part of NATO is enshrined in the Ukrainian constitution. So presumably the Russians would expect that to be taken out of the constitution. The Russians have also stated that they would not accept foreign military bases on the Ukrainian territory. However, the Ukrainians have stated that that actually is also already precluded from the constitution, and therefore that should be fine. There would be a question of how much assistance the Russians would allow Ukraine to get, because whilst the Russian side seems to be agreeing to Ukraine keeping some sort of an army, there is a question as to the size and the military support that the Western powers, who would be the presumed guarantors of such a deal, would be able to give Ukraine.
You've laid out a kind of ballpark for us of the things that neutrality could conceivably mean. One thing you haven't mentioned is Ukraine's application to join the EU.
Indeed. And at the moment, we don't know where the status of EU stands. We are assuming that if the Russian side had suggested, as Lavrov had noted and floated around, the idea of, for example, Austria model.
That's the Russian foreign minister.
The Russian foreign minister. And the Austria model is essentially one of neutrality, but a membership of the EU. Then perhaps that means that the Russians would accept Ukraine moving towards the path of becoming a member of the EU. The interesting question is about the status of the EU, because that has always been the stated Ukrainian goal. That may be a sticking point, but it may be also one that the Russian side can overcome. In terms of the red line, this is the status of Crimea. I think the Russians are absolutely talking about the fact that Crimea historically has been part of Russia and will continue being part of Russia. But of course, this would be a loss of territory and sovereignty over Crimea for the Ukrainians. There is therefore also the question of recognition of the Donbass. We assume that the Russians would not negotiate over that, but at this stage, we also don't know, although their stated aim is a recognition of Donbass. And after that, I think that there is a certain level of sort of flexibility. We assume that by now, with the fallout of the sanctions, the Russians would expect sanctions to be lifted. And that would be another red line. This is not something that's been talked about very openly during the negotiation process and the peace talks, but we are simply assuming that the lifting of sanctions would be a red line for the Russian regime. The question would be, for example, which sanctions, the ones that have been imposed in 2022, so over the last 3 weeks, or, for example, going as far back as 2014.
In other words, the sanctions that were imposed as a consequence of the annexation of Crimea.
That's right.
Okay. However, not achievable in a bilateral negotiation because they're not imposed by the Ukrainian government. I'm wondering whether Russia could conceivably, in your view, agree to the kinds of neutrality clauses that you've said, but give up on Ukraine recognising the annexation of Crimea or the Donbass.
The level of propaganda that the Russian, let's say, official media are currently putting forward with regards to Crimea does suggest that Crimea is a non-negotiable, which is a key red line for the Ukrainian regime. So this is where sort of the negotiations are going to be very difficult.
Crimea has effectively been Russian since 2014, but the Donbass and Luhansk haven't. Is the same true of them, or is Russia more flexible about their future?
That's an interesting question to which we don't precisely know the answer. The idea was to link the question of Donbass with the question of Crimea. But it actually, in some of the propaganda that we're seeing coming out of Russia, they seem to place more emphasis on Crimea as being non-negotiable than Donbass. So although the assumption would be that Ukraine would have to recognize the status of Donbass, we are not entirely sure at this stage whether this would be a red line. But the assumption would be that Russians would expect the Ukrainians to recognise it.
One of the problems that people have when negotiating a peace is how it's going to be taken back home. Do you think that this is a problem for Putin, given that he can practically sell anything he likes to the Russian people when it comes to media coverage?
The Russian public in many ways is actually, and sadly so, disengaged from what is going on in Ukraine. They are leaving it up to their leadership to sort of manage it. And so in that respect, when we're talking about sending it home, the important dynamic here is essentially Putin being able to sell it to himself rather than sending it to his own public.
Okay, so what we have as a red line is recognition of the annexation of Crimea, the recognition, you think, of these so-called breakaway regions, either as independent republics or for them to be annexed by Russia.
Yes.
And something called neutrality, which exists in the kind of area that you've talked about, certainly no NATO, but conceivably conditions placed upon Ukraine's military capacity and connections.
I think at this stage, this is probably roughly what the negotiators are currently discussing.
Is your sense that it's in that area that Russia might agree to withdraw its troops?
Because we do seem to be getting the sense that the Russians are not actually going to go for a direct regime change or insist on the direct regime change. There was already discussions floating around that they would be okay with President Zelensky staying in power, but perhaps with sort of a pro-Russian deputy. So I think, yes, I think we could perhaps see the Russian military starting to withdraw.
I suppose the big question here also is, do you think these negotiations are actually for real, at least on the Russian side?
But I think the difficulty is that a lot of military experts have been talking about the fact that after, you know, 2 or 3 weeks, the Russian side will essentially need to give their troops a break for them to be able to resupply and sort of regroup. And so a lot of military analysts, together with Western officials, are saying that the Russians are faking it and they're simply playing for time in order to give their troops some respite.
Aglaya Snetkov. So, we have our summaries of the room for manoeuvre between the Ukrainian and Russian positions. But any eventual agreement between Russia and Ukraine would also have big implications for the rest of Europe and for NATO. To discuss those and the chances of peace anytime soon are Anatole Levin, Senior Research Fellow on Russia and Europe at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft and a visiting professor at King's College London, and Dr. Julie Norman, lecturer in politics and international relations at University College London and co-director of its US Politics Centre. Julie Norman, it seems that Russia's red lines are firmly territorial. Now, is it a dangerous precedent set if borders get to be changed effectively by force?
Well, it indeed is a very dangerous precedent, and it's one reason why we haven't seen recognition of Russia's prior annexation of Crimea. It's especially important while the conflict is still going on. Any negotiations really around territory, I believe, will need to take place once there's actually a ceasefire. They will probably be a little bit later down the line, and right now the emphasis will be more on the ceasefire and the question of neutrality.
Now, would there be any anxiety, were there any concession on territory, that Russia, and particularly this Russian leader, would want to make territorial demands on any other countries?
Certainly, and that is has been a concern from the beginning of this Ukraine crisis. Obviously, we've seen, you know, a sense of threat in Georgia, Moldova, even Finland and Sweden, other areas that are outside of that NATO territory who fear that Russian aggression into their borders as well. So that's one reason why we've been seeing a shoring up of defense partnerships, obviously a shoring up of NATO forces in the eastern flank and trying to deter Russia from taking any of those actions.
Does that mean that if American advisers are talking to President Zelensky, they're likely to be saying, we kind of are with you on the question of territorial integrity because that's in our interest too?
Well, it certainly is there as a principle. And obviously going into negotiations, that will be Ukraine's as well as the US and other allies' position.
Anatole Levin, what kind of compromises could conceivably be made? I mean, you either hold a territory or you don't. Isn't that right?
Well, yes. But if you look at Turkey's occupation of northern Cyprus, if you look at the West's support for the independence of Kosovo, which, of course, is not recognized by the United Nations or many countries around the world, if you look at India's occupation of Kashmir, which everybody now accepts, except Pakistan, it is possible to shelve these issues in effect, semi-permanently. I mean, the only, as far as I can see, way out that would preserve a degree of international legitimacy and also democratic legitimacy would be local referenda to see what the local population actually wants under international supervision.
Which I imagine would be immensely tricky given how much of the population has now fled.
Well, yes, obviously that would have to be, in the case of the Donbass, delayed. There's a possibility and a problem. But by the way, another point I think to be made, you know, about this supposed Russian threat. If in 3 weeks the Russian army cannot take cities which are less than 20 miles from the Russian border, that the idea of the Russian army in future invading Finland or Sweden or Poland is empty. The problem about the Donbass is that, of course, the Russians are claiming that the Donbass includes the whole of those two provinces, but they don't actually occupy the whole of those two provinces. They're in the course of doing so, but they still haven't managed it in 3 weeks. And so there is also the question of just what the borders of the Donbass are.
Well, and Julie Norman, presumably there's a question mark about whether the peoples of those larger areas would actually want to be taken into so-called independent republics, which would in reality effectively be Russian client states.
Well, that's exactly right. And there has been suggestions for referendums or for some kind of vote. Putin obviously maintains and suggests that there would be great welcoming, you know, of this kind of annexation, where, of course, in reality, those territories are quite diverse within them. So it's not that clean as Putin likes to make out. And so that would be very tricky. And it's one reason why we saw the very difficulty of implementing the Minsk Accords for the last number of years leading up to this current situation.
The Minsk Accords was the attempt by Ukraine and Russia to resolve their problems after the annexation of Crimea.
Yes, and especially around the separatist region.
I think this is an appropriate point to look at this question of neutrality. Are there historical parallels, Anatole, for a position of neutrality? And what did that entail?
Well, certainly there are, somewhat different, but one was Finland, the Finnish-Soviet agreement, and the other was the Austrian state treaty by which Soviet and Western occupying forces withdrew from Austria in 1955. And the basic terms were that these countries couldn't join NATO, but they also could not join the Warsaw Pact. So, you know, Soviet Union was barred from trying to turn them into allies. And there were guarantees of their territorial integrity and non-interference in their internal affairs, which, by the way, the Soviet Union did keep to. And, of course, no military bases of outside powers on their soil. I mean, in the case of Ukraine, it seems Russia has demanded demilitarization. Now, that clearly, I mean, cannot involve the Ukrainians dissolving their army. But there have been suggestions from the Russian side that maybe it would only mean Ukraine not stationing long-range missiles. But I think the key point to be made about Finland and Austria is that, you know, I visited these countries during the Cold War. You could not know that they were not fully part of the West. So the point is to have a treaty of neutrality which preserves Ukraine's ability to move towards the West democratically, economically, in every other way.
Julie Norman, can you have neutrality effectively imposed upon you after an invasion and still be sovereign?
Well, indeed, this would need to be something that Ukraine, at least to some degree, agreed to. But it might be a compromise, and we've seen Zelensky indicate that it might be something that can be negotiated on the table.
Let's move on to something which it's difficult for me to see how it could be a direct part of negotiations between Ukraine and Russia, which is the question about whether the scrapping of sanctions, and after all, we're talking about several layers of sanctions, as any part of a peace deal. Anatole, is this actually realistic?
Well, why not? The sanctions were imposed in response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. They must be used, therefore, as a lever on Russia to end its invasion of Ukraine, reach a peace agreement that is acceptable to the Ukrainians, and withdraw its troops. The sanctions must be used to produce a good outcome for Ukraine, and, you know, not, I don't know, to display Western self-righteousness.
But some of those sanctions go back to 2014.
Well, they can stay, of course. Look at the news about the rise in food prices around the world, panic buying in the Middle East, deep anxiety in every major wheat importing country, especially the poor and unstable ones around the world. You know, look at the predictions of European and possibly global recession. I mean, we were absolutely correct to impose those sanctions, but we also have the strongest possible incentives to lift them as part of a successful peace process.
Julie Norman, Anton makes a very strong point with regard to the lifting of sanctions. But that, of course, doesn't mean that things will go back to the status quo ante. So you have other things like Germany's decision to cancel, or rather to put on ice, Nord Stream 2, and Europe's decision to try and seek its energy from elsewhere. Do you think that those initiatives will carry on?
Certainly, we're not just going to go back to the way it was. As we've seen, the UK has committed to moving off from Russian oil and gas. The EU is looking to decrease that by 2/3 within the next year. So we're going to see more of these long-term shifts away from some of those old partnerships. I think we're more likely to see softer lifting in some other areas, such as airspace, including, again, some of these exports and imports that are quite necessary, wheat, grain, these kinds of things. Because I do think we need to be careful. Again, there's a difference between principle and pragmatism on the question of sanctions. I agree we were right to impose them for both deterrence and punishment effect, but sanctions do hit a tipping point where they start first causing just undue punishment for the people, like the Russian people, prompting even more, kind of anti-Western sentiment, pushing Putin even closer to China or to other kinds of partners.
Right, let's come to the really tricky bit of the discussion where we try and guess what's actually going to happen now that we've sort of examined the moving parts. Julie Norman, we've had an exchange between President Biden and the Russian government this week about Vladimir Putin being a war criminal. And so one of the things we're wondering is, whatever now happens with regard to negotiations, it seems inconceivable that we can slip back somehow to the place where we were, or even anything remotely like it. In other words, we are, whether there are negotiations, successful negotiations or not, in a new Cold War.
That's certainly one way of framing it. And I think that's what many people are feeling right now. And it's certainly going to be a reality for Europe to reframe their whole thinking about Russia moving forward. But I do push back a little bit at the Cold War rhetoric. And I think even Biden's use of the word war criminal was rather off the cuff yesterday. And it's one that, again, in reality, the US as well as the UK and the EU is going to probably need to keep dealing with Putin moving forward. He still has, significant support within Russia. The US and NATO and even with the sanctions have not really been pushing for regime change in that way, even if it's something many would like to see. And so, again, there's just a certain reality of the fact that they will need to keep dealing with Putin and also just with Russia as a very integrated actor.
But I suppose what I'm asking is, even after a peace in Ukraine, are we now effectively in a situation of Cold War?
Well, I think we're in a situation of seeing Russia as a different kind of threat and a different kind of state than we did in the past. But again, Russia does not have the same ideological sway over large parts of the globe as they did during the Cold War. This is not as much a battle of ideologies, even though some in the West have framed it that way lately, as much as just a very overt act of aggression by one state against another. So to me, it's more responding to Putin and what he is representing right now for Russia, rather than a broader ideological Cold War with proxy elements and whatnot.
Anatole, even the dread question, what's your best guess as of today as to what's going to happen?
I hope I'm not engaging in wishful thinking that possibly once Russia has captured what's left of Mariupol and the whole of the Donbass, that the Russians will be prepared possibly to declare a unilateral ceasefire and that the negotiations will succeed in a treaty of neutrality and at the same time a solution, if only a provisional one, to Crimea and the Donbass, or that these issues will be compartmentalised and kicked down the road.
And Julie Norman, same question to you.
Yeah, I would like to be hopeful as well with a similar kind of framing. And about a week ago, I would not have been as optimistic, but I do sense there has been a shift in what we're hearing from the negotiations this week, and also just the costs that are being borne now by both the Russian military as well as, of course, by Ukraine. Again, this will really depend on the actual implementation of a ceasefire. And we just know from past conflicts, there's likely to be a bit sliding back and some spoiler effects in the midst of all this. But I do see that there might be some crack towards a negotiated solution.
That was Julie Norman with Anatole Levin. My thanks to them, Oleksiy Semeny and Aglaya Snetkov. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirsty Knight, Ben Carter and Rosamund Jones. The programme was mixed by Neil Churchill and the editor was Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon, and you can find them all on BBC Sounds.
All right, here we go, OT. 5, 6, 7, 8.
Dance. It has the power to connect and to entertain. And in a new series for BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, I explore the iconic dancers who have been doing just that.
Dance, it really, I think, saved my life.
Join me, Oti Mabuse, as I delve into the lives of the innovators and the mold breakers who have changed dance forever.
Gene Kelly was this working class guy that I just really connected with that.
Oti Mabuse's Dancing Legends on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.